Welcome to another edition of Critical Thinking. I'm your host and producer for this series, Andrew Pattner. The American-born, European, and Canada, for the most part, based conductor, Kent Nagano, was in Chicago this spring and presented a very interesting and controversial performance or set of performances of the Brahms Requiem with interpolations of a piece commissioned by Nagano and one of his former orchestras in Berlin, Germany, music of Wolfgang Riem. This four sections of instrumental music was inserted between various of the parts of the famous German Requiem of Johannes Brahms. Mr. Nagano explained his reasoning, said there was historical precedent for this, going back to the time of Brahms himself and various presentations of the Requiem that Brahms had been involved with in Germany. We're going to come to the controversy around this type of a presentation as we bring you our interview with Kent Nagano. I think there are legitimate arguments to be made on either side of this point, but we thought we would open the program with some music by Wolfgang Riem. Now, I should tell you that several members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra proposed to me that the next time that the CSO does any music by Wolfgang Riem, they ought to do it with interpolations of pieces by Johannes Brahms stuck between sections of Mr. Riem's pieces. Well, we've come up with a compromise here. We're going to open the show with the last section, Takt, or bar, of Wolfgang Riem's Gesungene Zeit from 1991-92, music for violin and orchestra, Time Chant. And this is a work dedicated to Anna-Sophie Mutter. Anna-Sophie Mutter will be the soloist. James Levine will be the conductor. And it's the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Music of Wolfgang Riem, the latter half or so of Time Chant, as a curtain raiser to part one of a two-part conversation with conductor Kent Nagano.
Thank you.
music of Wolfgang Riem, the second half, Takt or Bar, Gesungene Zeit, Time Chant, music for violin and orchestra, Anna-Sophie Mutter, James Levine conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, a 1992 recording and a 1993 Grammy winner because of the Berg Violin Concert, violin concerto on the same album. All of this bringing us now to a storage room in the basement of Orchestra Hall. 7 or 8 summers ago, I was at the Salzburg Festival, and I had the opportunity to see, I don't know the right word, if it was a revival, a rediscovery, a relaunching of a major opera I had neither seen before nor heard, even on a broadcast or a recording. It was Dr. Faust of Ferruccio Busoni in a remarkable production by Peter Musbach and beautifully conducted and led from the orchestra pit by our guest today, Kent Nagano. I knew of Mr. Nagano's name before that. Like many people in the United States, we have heard about and read about and heard broadcasts of an American conductor whose career has taken place mostly outside of the United States, with some important exceptions that we'll come to. But this was my first chance to really see him in his element, not hurt by Thomas Hampson in a major role and others in that wonderful production. Since then, he's landed a number of important assignments and posts around the world, and most recently this season began 2 major international jobs, positions. One is music director of the Bayerische Staatsoper, the Bavarian State Opera in Munich, and as music director of the Montreal Symphony Orchestra in Montreal. We spoke with Mr. Nagano when he was in Chicago to conduct a program he had devised with, in, and around the Brahms Requiem. Welcome to Chicago, and thanks for talking with us, Kent Nagano.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Why don't we start with Busoni, just because it still rings so much in my head, but maybe also because it gives a sense of how you've done the things that you've done and where they've come from and where they've led. How did that project come about?
The Busoni, Dr. Faustus, is a work that nearly everyone agrees universally is Busoni's great masterpiece. Busoni, of course, was a very colorful personality, a pioneer composer, an advocate of many other of his contemporaries, set the stage for really a very, very large exposure for a number of composers at the early part of the 20th century, and yet was equally respected as a conductor and as a composer and as a pianist, a virtuoso pianist. Because of that, a lot of people see in Busoni's compositional output an enormous amount of eclecticism, and that I would say would be the most constant criticism that one hears of his music. But there are exceptions to which people just agree, and through consensus over now a century of time, that he was capable of writing exceptional, great, great masterpieces. Most of them for the keyboard, mm-hmm. But then this Dr. Faustus is an extraordinary creation. It's very difficult to perform for a number of reasons. The orchestra is large, demands unusual virtuosity from all of the various instrument families. The cast is also large and primarily male, mm-hmm. So to assemble simply that number of leading male voices is always a challenge for scheduling reasons. But I think probably that's why it's under unusual circumstances that you can find the chance to really put together a performance that's exceptional. One would have been at the Opera de Lyon, where mm-hmm. we did our production and then put together with it a recording plan. And the second was at the wonderful Salzburg Festival, the performance you attended, where still the tradition is that cast and conductor work together for nearly a 2-month period, uninterrupted, and just focus solely on the goal of putting together a coherent and well thought out production.
Not exactly how we're able to do it in most American opera houses.
Not only
just about anywhere.
Yes.
Lyon was a very important
place for you and a place where you developed a number of ideas and connections and gained a great deal of experience as well.
It was a wonderful opportunity, and most of that opportunity, I would say, was because it was a situation where a number of people with special talents came together who just happened to see a common goal and to share a common set of aesthetic sensibilities. And that included my colleagues in the orchestra. Everyone was so united in terms of the direction that we wanted to go as artists. And part of that, I think, was the stimulation, the inspiration to try to create a particular Lyonnais character, a personality. We had very strong individual personalities and characters as a part of not only the orchestra, but the administrative staff, exceptionally large egos, but at the same time, under the same umbrella of trying to achieve a common goal. I think that kind of energy, it doesn't always come together. It very much depends a large amount on chance. It's above and beyond simply talent. It's mm-hmm. that moment in time, the good chance where people come together and obviously have a common goal. And I think that was one of the most important advantages of working in Lyon.
But there also has to be that desire, that common desire. You need the talent, you need the chance of who's involved. But Daniel Barenboim, our most recent music director here in Chicago, who sometimes can paint with a broad brush with his pronouncements, but he very often in recent years would speak about the crisis from his point of view of orchestras in this country and elsewhere and ensembles not having the desire to see themselves collectively as artists and to want to work towards an artistic goal overall. Of course, performance to performance, rehearsal to rehearsal, that is certainly present in any fine ensemble. But he has argued that we've lost sight in some places of the idea that there should be a common artistic enterprise for any orchestra or ensemble. And I don't know if you're giving us the positive side of that by saying it did exist in Lyon, or if you also have found from your work around the globe that that's something that perhaps professionalization, quote unquote, has maybe replaced that more free and experimental and driven joint artistry.
The world is definitely a concept that's not fixed. It's under constant evolution, constant change. And within that change, of course, is an entire spectrum of complications that at that particular time and moment sometimes can be very difficult to understand. And yes, I recognize what Maestro Barenboim is speaking about. It is complicated and problematic times. On the other hand, the most interesting aspect about recognizing a problem, and here I'm sure Mr. Barenboim would agree, is not to be able to define a problem, because that's really only the first step of a process, is to be able to foresee a solution or to work towards some kind of resolution or some sort of direction which offers opening of the doors so that one can find a way forward. Simply identifying a problem, while it's helpful in some terms, is not the point. The point is actually to work together collectively towards a solution. To me, and to many artists that I know, if not most artists whom I know, the key is to make sure that our great works of art remain clearly relevant to ourselves and also to our public. If people recognize this rich and now very, very long tradition that we've been fortunate enough to inherit, one also at the same time needs to realize that unless these great works of art remain relevant such that through our daily experiences in 2007, 2008, that we can apply personally our own experiences to what the content is that lies within these great pieces. If we can't do that, then those of us who are fortunate and privileged enough to to have inherited this tradition won't be able to pass it on to the next, to our children's generation. Mm-hmm. That relevance aspect is not something that can be achieved through passiveness. It takes a very, very concentrated search and research and research, again, to make sure that these great, great masterpieces are constantly put under under question, constantly reanalyzed, constantly rethought out, because through discovering what makes them so special, why certain works, and these are very few works that we're talking about, achieve this rare status as masterpiece, why do they speak above time? Why do they have the ability to speak beyond eternity? And why do they have the ability to speak across boundary, international boundaries? Mm-hmm. We'll never know the answers, of course, but unless we actively engage in and re-exercising these questions, we'll never come close to trying to find a way forward from this phenomenon that Mr. Barenboim has been speaking about.
In the world of opera, some of that investigation and that attempt to seek, discover, impose relevance takes place by creating different contexts for the production, or maybe even physically moving a production out of an opera house and into a more public space. Or now in Europe for some time there have been big screen broadcasts outside of houses. You've been involved with those things. The Met now has been doing that for its opening night in New York, and now has been beaming performances into theaters. For the instrumental or symphonic repertoire, those interventions have to be done in a very different way. And you have helped to initiate and brought to Chicago an unusual and very provocative and, to be honest, from the reactions of very many people, controversial way of looking at one of these works, a German Requiem of Johannes Brahms, which you presented with a set of pieces, or a piece with four parts by Wolfgang Riem, the contemporary German composer, and these parts were inserted between spaces between the seven movements of the Brahms. Tell us something about that and how you've felt about it, having done it now in Germany as well now as in Chicago.
The most important aspect of performance is to respect the context of tradition and to respect a composer's intent. We need to have this as starting points before we can then have the license, if you will, to then engage our own subjective elements into an interpretation. Those two, to respect the traditional and the context of the tradition and the intentions of the composer, I think most artists would agree that that these are fundamental concerns that simply must be observed. The tradition, however, is a word that oftentimes is misunderstood. What is tradition? It's something that constantly needs redefinition. For example, as you mentioned, I've just begun now working at with a Bayerische Staatsorchester with a tradition that's 467 years old. One of our first music directors was Orlando de Lassus, and
he was also born in Berkeley, wasn't he?
And it's very interesting to see how the Staatsoper, Staatsorchester, relates to what we might call a tradition, something spanning hundreds and hundreds of years old. Oftentimes, we find that tradition is defined erroneously, is that which we remember in our own personal experience. We tend to call that tradition. For example, if one is preparing, is in a rehearsal with a soloist, and the soloist does something very unusual or particular, oftentimes one hears as an explanation, well, that's the way it's always been done. Mm-hmm. But what does that always been done mean? Does that mean always been done since the time of caveman, or does that mean since the past 40 years, or does that mean since as long as they've been listening to music, or as long as they've heard it within their own lifetimes? We don't, I mean, these are, or is a tradition a habit, what we're used to doing?
So I was wondering, the habit, memory, repetition, tradition, custom, these are not necessarily all the same things.
They're decidedly not the same things, because a tradition, if we look through the perspective of history, is something that's very much alive, and it's essential to all of us. It's essential to celebrate, to respect, to nourish, and to preserve tradition. Why is that? Isn't tradition simply looking in a rearview mirror and looking backwards? Well, actually, no, it's not, because it takes very active research to keep a sense of tradition alive. How many times have we, through various discoveries, found a refocusing of tradition, mm-hmm. and found out that what we erroneously thought is something was in fact something else? But without a very clear idea of tradition or from where we come, it's almost impossible to figure out where we are today. If you just think of just basic navigation, unless you know where you're coming from, you can't figure out where you are right now. And if you can't figure out where you are right now through whatever that identity means, it's going to be equally impossible to chart a future. So we need the tradition, in a sense, to understand how we can go forward. It's such a vital part of our identity. It's such a vital part of how we understand the context in which we perform. But that tradition, of course, as I've mentioned a couple of times, it's something that we, at least as artists, shoulder as a very important responsibility through study and restudying. And if one looks, for example, at the performances of the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven or the Brahms Requiem, these are very familiar works to us now. There's nothing wrong with familiarity. It offers a context as well. But it is important to realize that when the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven was first performed, that it was a decided non-success. It created controversy. It stirred enormous criticism. In fact, one of the critiques that one can still read today was making an excuse for the great master that somehow he was thinking of these harmonies because perhaps it's because he lost his hearing. I mean, it's amazing to think of how much instability that creation of the Ninth Symphony had as an impact during its own time, and that's why it changed the course of music and how we think about symphonic form. Even today, we still feel the weight of the impact of the Ninth Symphony. And likewise with the Brahms Symphony, one of the very first times when subjective and individual thought was given to how to offer comfort through the form of a requiem, to step away from the official liturgical structure, to choose and select a text of your own volition, something that had personal meaning. This was very radical at its time, yes. And when it was performed, it created severe controversy, so that people talked about it. And mm-hmm. as people began to talk about it, of course, it had resonance and meaning to those who had an opinion, to those who had a belief, to those, of course, who had suffered loss on their own. Such controversy that the controversy followed Brahms for many years afterwards. And as I've mentioned in some of the pre-concert lectures, the controversy was so intense that those first two performances had other works which functioned as interpolations, mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. The Schubert Rosamunde music, excerpts from Handel Messiah, St. John's Passion. When a work is born out of that much emotion and that much spirit, it can't help but have a tremendous impact on all of the events that happens afterwards. And if one thinks about it now, in retrospect, the impact that the Brahms Requiem had, we still refer to it as a German Requiem today, mm-hmm. as in specifically away from the Latin text.
Right.
Is it right then to only refer back to a great masterpiece as something familiar? Or is it important to realize the strength and the power of the visionary Brahms, the revolutionary Brahms, the pioneer of a Brahms? What that meant not only in his time in terms of confronting people with issues that they should look at and refer to from their own personal perspective? Or are these works so important to our children's generation, that they should be looked at again and seen through the lens of that power, that innovation, that revolution, and that, yes, again, that visionary concept that Johannes Brahms had that changed the course of music through his composition?
Let me offer a few reactions to that, because I think you make a very strong and eloquent case for this kind of a relook, reinterpretation, re-presentation. But I also think that there's something to be said for some of the different responses to that. I was very moved by the performance. I wasn't sure what to expect. I had not heard a recording of this. I intentionally didn't want to look at the Rim score first, because I wanted to see what it would feel like and be like, and also get a sense of what the other audience members might experience. And the person I went with and I, we were very moved, and I felt these were underscores in some ways, even amplifications of things. But I also couldn't help but think that for someone who has not heard the work as often as others have, and it's certainly not any of your doing that it hasn't been done in Chicago in about 8 seasons, but and before that I think it was about 5 seasons. So I almost wish that if there had been time and money and so on to allow this, there could have been performances both with the Rim and without the Rim, so that people could have made that kind of a comparison. Because there certainly, it is a piece that has an arc to it and it has a shape to it. It also would have been nice, I'm sure you agree, if there had been larger music stands or something, because watching you all, conductor and players, have to wrestle back and forth between the two sets of scores did make us have some concern for how much consolation there was going to be.
It was a bit of a choreography that was going on there for sure. And of course, your points are very well taken. And I should also add that usually when I perform the Brahms Requiem, and it is an important part of my repertoire, it is without the Rim context. It's not something that is automatically done. It's done, well, hopefully, with taking a certain perspective interview.
It's great to hear somebody use the word hopefully correctly. Please continue. I mean, doing it with hope. That's exactly what you were doing. So, yeah.
And when one chooses to really try to study carefully a composer's intent, it's with the full knowledge that it would be audacious that we should take the position that we know what a composer wanted, because we don't. For example, if someone were to say, well, this is how Johann Sebastian Bach would have performed a piece, it's rather dangerous to take that position, because as far as I know, no one living today really remembers how Bach would have performed. No, as scholars all agree, we can only, through our research, have glimpses of what might have been.
And especially when one thinks of Bach, Brahms, these were people who were themselves improvisers. And once they published their music, they obviously knew other people would be playing it, who would also embellish, improvise, or somehow interact, to use a less felicitous word. I should also make clear that one of the other things I felt, and I think everybody that I could feel in the audience, whatever camp they might have been in, with your performance of the Brahms, qua Brahms, was you brought over, I think, beautifully that even in the instrumental portions of the work, this work is a vocally informed work. I mean, I felt your interpretation just had the whole piece singing. There was a very lyrical and even lilting quality throughout, rather than this idea of, okay, it's an orchestral work with chorus or a choral work with orchestra. I felt that you had taken the whole thing as a work coming out of a soul and of a person who as Handel has in one of his interpolated pieces, wants to tell a story to an audience. And I thought that was something that is rarely done and that was done very beautifully by you and the orchestra and chorus.
Thank you very much for that observation. Of course, it's to be able to perform a work with an overriding fundamental of content, one needs exceptional colleagues and partners. And to do such a great work with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and of course the Chicago Symphony Orchestra chorus, is exceptional. And I was very, very moved and grateful to have had the chance to collaborate with these two great institutions.
And also this idea in the first half, I think everyone would say this was illuminating, even if they wouldn't admit the rest was illuminating when it was. But having the Schütz setting of the 100th Psalm and having the first Chicago performance, or at least first, it must be first performance, but certainly first Chicago Symphony performance of the late work of Berent Alois Zimmermann from 1970, sort of a prelude and a postlude historically to the Brahms, putting that in the first half. I mean, that type of programming is I think too rare, that where people really get a chance to think about, circle and arrive at a work rather than, okay, this fits nicely with or is a good contrast to this, and we haven't done any Bartok lately, so we have that, and our composer in residence wrote this for viola. And now there are reasons in a 50-week or 30-week season that you can't have every program be too intense, I think, to do every program this way.
I think one does have to take into account practical concerns that, I mean, that was one of the reasons why I was so thrilled, really tickled, that one of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra percussion players took the time to master the musical saw. That was very, very impressive, and he played it magnificently.
Beautifully, and it's seated in the string section.
And not only played it, but really interpreted it.
Yeah.
That's really shows enormous dedication to the feel of music. If you not only master a new instrument, but you master it to the level where you're able to then bring through a real interpretation, human meaning. But of course, to me, as I mentioned at the very beginning, I am quite concerned, and I share this concern almost with all of my colleagues, that that the public be able to understand that what makes great works of music so great is that it is speaking, it's speaking for us in real terms that involve today's life. To think somehow that we're revering pieces that whose time has gone by and we're looking back at 150 years alone, somehow this doesn't provide the full dimensions and the full depth of the piece so that we can pass it on then to the next mm-hmm. generation. And the combination of works for this program, the Zimmermann, the Schütz, the Riem, the Brahms, they're all looking at the idea of loss and tragedy mm-hmm. from a personal and subjective point of view. That was the point that Brahms so radically put forward, that one could suffer ideas of loss and but share it as a personal observation rather than framed within a formal structure or a mm-hmm. dogmatic structure. That was the one thing in common of the other three composers, was dealing with this melancholy or this sense of loss. And of course, this is something that we all feel regardless of our cultural backgrounds, regardless of what epoch we happen to live in terms of whom we happen to be, what walks of life we are, what nationality we happen to be. It's something simply humanistic. It's something we all feel. And to be able to have that human expression, but as represented through creative thought at different points in history, to me, well, hopefully, it was so that we could realize that this emotion is something that we've always felt since time has begun, mm-hmm. truly time has begun, and it's something that our children will feel as well.
We thought we would conclude this evening's program, the first of a two-part conversation with music, with conductor Kent Nagano, with an example of recorded music led by Kent Nagano, music of our own time, in this case, the Phaedra, dramatic cantata opus 93 for mezzo-soprano and small orchestra of the late Benjamin Britten, written in 1975. Britten died in 1976. This was his last major composition for solo voice. This is Kent Nagano leading the Halle Orchestra, and it's a particularly special recording because, made as it was in 1995, it features one of the great mezzos of our time, a woman who at that time was known as Lorraine Hunt, and later Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, and of course her death last year deprived us of one of the truly great artists of our time in the vocal or in any part of the world. So we're going to hear Kent Nagano, the Halle Orchestra, the great Lorraine Hunt, his mezzo, Benjamin Britten, Phaedra, dramatic cantata, opus 93 for mezzo-soprano and small orchestra. The story, of course, coming to us from the Greeks, that of the one tough, angry lady, Phaedra.
And dazzled eyes saw only night. Capricious burnings flickered through my bleak, abandoned flesh. I could not breathe or speak. I faced my flaming executioner, Aphrodite, my mother's murderer. To calm her wrath by flowers and praise, I built her a temple, fretted months and days. Lord, your highness. It was I who lusted for your son with my hot eye. The flint of a brunette has maddened me. Then Inoni's tears troubled my mind. She played upon my fears until her bleeding forced me to declare I loved your son.
A work written for Dame Janet Baker at the end of the life of Benjamin Britten, Phaedra, dramatic cantata, opus 93 for mezzo and small orchestra, in this case, performed by one of the few great successors to Janet Baker, the late Lorraine Hunt, as she was known at the time of this recording. Timothy Ho was the leader or concertmaster of the Holly Orchestra, Peter Worrall, the cello soloist Janet Simpson, harpsichord, Kent Nagano leading all of that, this by way of rounding out the first of our two programs with conductor Kent Nagano. Next week, we'll be talking with Mr. Nagano about his work with the Munich Opera, the Bavarian State Opera. I'm actually, as you hear this, over in Munich, listening to the first opera festival under the direction, artistic direction, of Kent Nagano in his new position as music director of the Bayerischer Staatsoper. We'd like to thank Eric Arunas for recording today's interview for us in a basement in Orchestra Hall, not our usual basement. Matt DeStefano, who, of course, makes this program sound great each week. We'd like to thank our funders, Draupner LLC, a Chicago-based private equity firm, and Alphawood Foundation, as well as other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at RENTAP, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P, at AOL.com. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week for part two of this conversation with American-born conductor Kent Nagano.